guys, welcome back to Believe in TCU Football with JD and Lauren Cottrell. Today we have a very special guest with us today, former Baylor and Tampa Bay Buccaneer center, Randy Grimes. Randy, we want to thank you so much for joining us today and, you know, taking time out of your day to, you know, kind of listen to us and answer a few questions. And so, you know, I read up a little bit on you, you know, over the past week, and I'd really love to just start off and, you know, hear your story and a little bit on your background.
Well, okay, I'm a Tyler Robert E. Lee graduate from Tyler, Texas. Played at Baylor, was drafted in the second round by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I met my wife the very first day, our freshman year at Baylor. We went out that night. We got married after our junior years. She was going to teach and I was going to coach. We were going to live that All-American dream, you know. But I got drafted by the Bucs in the second round. I was the 45th player selected, the second center taken that year behind Dave Remington. And, you know, the first thing I learned, the guy next to me in my locker at the Buccaneers was a former All-Pro and a Hall of Famer named Leroy Selman. And he was really the first conversation that I had in the pros, or the first real conversation from, you know, somebody that I'd watched forever, you know, play the game on TV and a legend in my mind. And, you know, the first thing I learned about professional football is that it wasn't a game anymore, that it was now a job. And the second thing I learned was you do whatever you have to stay out on the field, you know. And so for me, I was not going to be that guy who got a reputation of always being in the doctor's office or always missing practice or always on the injury report or always whining about this little knick-knacky injury or whatever. So, you know, that for me, it was taking handfuls of pain pills every day and practicing through the little injuries and the different things that was going on and taking handfuls of sleeping pills at night, you know, to get to sleep through the throbbing pain. And, you know, I looked at it like a necessary evil. I wanted to be the best center that ever played the game. I wanted to feed my family. I wanted to play forever. Those are ways that I justified what I was calling a necessary evil, but in reality, it was a full blown addiction. And, you know, that kind of took over my career, although I kept playing good, you know. I mean, that necessary evil progressed to the point where the last 2 years of my career, I was playing the entire games in a blackout, you know, and I was the center. I was the quarterback of the offensive line. I was telling guys, you know, I was changing blocking assignments. I was getting guys going in the right direction. I was having to listen to the snap count. I was having to shotgun the ball back to the quarterback. I was having to do all that in an NFL game every Sunday, and I was doing it in a complete blackout. But that's the insanity of this disease, and that's what it progressed to. And, you know, I can also remember the 10 years that I was in Tampa. I had 5 different head coaches. We were a revolving door of players, coaches, quarterbacks, front office people. You know, we never really got any real consistency going. But the last coach that I had, Sam Weish, I had 5 head coaches, 6 different offensive line coaches in 10 years. But the last coach I had was Sam Weish, and I remember him putting his hand on my shoulder and telling me that my services wouldn't be needed anymore in Tampa. And I can remember thinking, wow, that's how it ends? You know, all the blood, sweat, and tears that I've left on football fields all over this country since 4th grade, and that's how it ends with a coach that has no loyalties to me. I have none to him. We probably don't really even like each other. We don't really know each other. We've only been together for a half a year. And I'd been hurt that year, so I knew I couldn't go anywhere else. And I just remember thinking, that's how it ends? And I just remember raking everything out of my locker into a black trash bag after the last game of the year and walking out the back door. And Randy Grimes, the football player, didn't exist anymore. And the reason that I tell that story is because I already had this raging addiction going. And now the fact that you've taken away my uniform and my playbook and my itinerary and everything that was my identity, And I didn't transition well. You know, I struggled for a long time trying to figure out who I was when I wasn't Randy Grimes, the football player anymore.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask that because, you know, that's tough. And me and JD have talked about that multiple times, you know, even, you know, football players in general, just after, you know, the game is done for them, how they go about that transition and finding that next thing in life. Can you tell us a little bit about that transition?
Well, and you think that you're prepared for it. You kind of mentally start preparing for it. You have kind of a plan in place, but until it really happens, you're never prepared for it. You know, I was going to go to work for my agent. I was going to be able to stay in the game in some capacity by helping him recruit players out of college, but that didn't work out. And it's not just football players. And, you know, I work with a lot of veterans. I work with a lot of recently retired executives. I mean, we as Americans just don't transition well, whether it's a college graduate coming out of school and can't find a job, or a broken marriage. You know, we just don't transition very well. And, you know, we also are a country that, you know, our first instinct is to self-medicate that. So, you know, we go see a doctor, or we don't see a doctor. We just start doing it ourselves. But, you know, we start throwing prescription medication or whatever it takes at whatever numbs you up. So, that's something that I talk a lot about with when I work with athletes, I work with the families, you know, is that transitional trauma of losing that self-esteem, losing that identity, you know, that depression that comes with that isolation. You know, that suffer in silence mentality, and especially us guys, because our fathers raised us like that, you know, where we suffer and so big boys don't cry. You know, you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and get back in the huddle, that kind of mentality. And, you know, that's the message I'm trying to change today, is that it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to not ask for help. Because there is help and hope and resources out there now.
Yeah, most definitely. And I want to jump in on that a little bit, Randy. I was fortunate enough to make it to the NFL as well. And you talked about that process of getting that trash bag, right? It's almost comparable to kind of watching yourself die, because this is what you've done for so long. You know, I got a chance to go through preseason camp and all that stuff with the Broncos, and I can remember my teammate being there one day and being gone the next, and they, you know, refilling their locker with a new body, with a new person, and just watching that revolving door, as you said. And I think it's super important. I love the fact of what you're doing is trying to change that narrative of transition, because it's really hard. It really is. If you didn't put, you know, so much time, energy, effort, and your life into the one thing that you find as your identity, when that's taken away, it's super hard. I know I struggled with that for a long time. And one of the things I wanted to ask you was, is, you know, what are some of the things that helped you kind of reestablish your identity or just refind yourself again after kind of transitioning out of that?
Well, and the first thing I had to do that I didn't even know I had to do, and I learned this while I was in treatment, was I had to finally grieve the death of Randy Grimes, the football player. You know, sure, I had to reinvent myself and resurrect myself, but you know, I had to grieve that death. And I didn't realize that I didn't even realize that that was a process, you know, until I was taken through it. And man, it was just like grieving the death, you know, any death. You know, I'm grateful that that happened. And we try to walk through that when I'm working with athletes today. You know, we try to have that same kind of moment. But I think it's important to reinvent yourself. What are your interests? You know, what is it that you want to do? You know, and if you don't know what that is, what's your passion? Because through your passion, you'll find your purpose. And those are the kind of things that we kind of like to, or what we try to do with the guys when they come through.
For sure. And, you know, something that, you know, I've kind of been interested about, and I'm sure the listeners would be interested about too. You know, you speak out for pro athletes in addiction. And, you know, if you guys want to check that out, it's called proathletesinrecovery.org. But, you know, for you personally, what was that moment? You speak about, you know, reaching out for help. What was that moment where it kind of clicked for you and you were like, you know, I need help. I'm done.
You know, I was laying in the floor of a vacant house with no utilities, no car in the driveway, no job, no money in the bank. And I can remember laying in the floor of that dark house, and it had some carpet and I had a blanket and a little box TV. That's all I had there. And I can remember thinking, you know, I was a former All-American. I was a second round draft pick. I married my cheerleader dream girl wife. You know, I had two great children. I was the 1988 NFL Man of the Year from the Buccaneers. You know, I was a Pro Bowler. And here I am laying in the floor of this vacant house with no utilities, no car, no money, no job, no friends, no hope. And I can remember having those thoughts laying there. And my daughter wouldn't let me come around my first grandson, you know, because I wasn't fit to be around him. I was having seizures as a result of withdrawal from the benzodiazepines. My wife, she didn't leave me, but she couldn't live with me anymore. So she moved in with her parents, you know, because she realized she was loving me to death and she couldn't just watch me continue to kill myself. So that was the perfect storm that finally made the death of my friend, Tom McHale, somebody that I played with in Tampa for many years. He was my right guard. He was out there doing the same thing I was doing. That was self-medicating his injuries he got while he played with the Bucks. And one morning he just didn't wake up. So that whole perfect storm was coming together in the summer of 2009. And that's when I finally put up my hand and asked for help. And back then, this is in 2009, there was no resources out there for former NFL players. So that was kind of the birth of Athletes in Recovery. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it or how I was going to do it, but I knew that there was a lot of guys out there just like me that were suffering in silence. And for whatever reason, pride, ego, guilt, shame, they weren't putting their hands up and asking for help. But once they heard my story, once they realized that they weren't alone, they weren't the only ones struggling like that, then they started putting up their hand and coming out of the woodwork. And we were able to help hundreds and hundreds of former players. And the next thing I know, Major League Baseball got involved. And then NHL and NBA, and then the Jockeys Guild, and then former race car drivers, and then former MMA fighters and golfers and tennis pros. And, I found that everybody had the same issues. Yeah, everybody had chronic pain, but it was all something to do with transitioning out of their sport, not having that identity, not having that racket to pick up or that horse to get on or that car to drive. And people struggled with that.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That is an amazing story. I love the way you painted that picture of it being a perfect storm for you to take the opportunity, because I can say that there are opportunities for and not just athletes. I mean, Americans in general, to make that step, make that transition. But it's what you said. It's the pride, the ego, the memories, the accomplishments, the praise that you got once before that's no longer there, that, you know, kind of made you feel like somebody. And so I could imagine that it took, you know, a great deal of humility to really, really put your hand up and say, hey, I need help. I got to figure this out. I can't continue like this. And so, you know, for, you know, the listener that's tuning in, because this happens every year, right? You know, I heard someone say it recently that, you know, every year a guy gets drafted to replace another guy. And so that means that one guy's transitioning in, one guy's transitioning out. And for the guy that's transitioning out, whether he's, you know, a 10-year vet like yourself, or whether he's just a preseason camp guy or whatever you may have it, you know, what would be some steps that you would give him to, you know, kind of start that process?
Well, and I think it starts way back in college. You know, I think you're always preparing for your next level. And if you're fortunate enough to get there, then good for you. But you should always be preparing for the end, because as you know, as well as I do, that could be the next play, you know, if you're lucky enough to have the next play. But You know, I think now there's more opportunities out there. I think that there's the NFL has come a long way with helping guys transition. I don't think they've mastered it by any means, but I think that they have programs now that are helping guys. They have job fairs. They have trainings in the off season. If you can find something that you're interested in, they will help you get there. If they won't do it, then the NFLPA, the Players Association, will. And I think there's just a lot more opportunities now for guys to get plugged in before they leave the game, you know, find their interest, find their passion. And, you know, the main thing is, you know, don't fall into that trap of self-medicating and thinking that numbing up and escaping life on life's terms, you know, that's going to be your fix, because, you know, it always turns out the same for everybody, you know. And that's certainly not a solution. And you know, thank God there's more non-narcotic ways to deal with chronic pain now and different techniques. So there's really no reason at all to go down that road.
You know, Randy, I love that you've taken, you know, a story about, I guess, destruction, you could say, and turned it into something incredible. And I love that, you know, you're kind of the face of helping out these guys, you know, transition from something that's been there their entire life and trying to find, you know, something new. And I saw that, you know, you had a book that was, what did it release this summer?
No, it's going to be a Super Bowl release.
Oh, okay.
This year in LA, it's going to be a release. Hey, and you know, the beautiful thing about that, whether I sell a copy or not, I could care less, but my whole family had a platform in it. You know, they participated in it and they were a part of it. And it was a huge healing thing for all of us in my family, you know, with my children and my wife and even my mom, you know, and my brother and my sister. Everybody had a little piece of it. And it was kind of a cool thing to watch everybody, you know, finally kind of, you know, really healing from it.
That's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit about the book? I know it's called Off Center.
Yeah, it's called Off Center. And basically it's my story being told parallel with a fictional intervention that's going on. So there's really two stories going on the whole book. And I hope it's not real confusing, you know, to read, but it's, there's a lot of characters. There's a lot of humor in it, but there's also a lot of real life stuff that we go through in our addiction. You know, there's a lot of dark places in that book about where that addiction took me and what I was willing to do to keep it going. So it was a healing book for me too, to finally get out. So I'm real excited about it. It's at final editing now, and we're planning on a Super Bowl release in LA.
That's amazing. I can't wait to order a copy myself. Because
yeah, you'll have two copies sold.
Yeah, for sure. you got mine already. And I think too, on the flip side of that, I think that it's amazing that you're being transparent with that process and how it really looked, because as you know, like, from a fan's perspective, it looks one way, you know, he just no longer plays anymore. But from the other side of the table, it's like, no, these are real life thoughts and feelings and situations and actions that are being taken because you no longer have the identity. So I love the fact that you're like being transparent in that book and letting people see the dark side of it, because it truly is a true detachment from, you know, what you love to do so much.
Yeah. And, you know, I often wonder, you know, why did it happen to me? You know, I don't have any addiction in my family. I don't have any of the precursors for addiction or anything like that. But, you know, it's almost like I realize now that, you know, it's first of all, I don't blame the NFL or blame the Buccaneers or anything. You know, I'm responsible for everything I put in my mouth. You know, they made it available for me. And that was just the era that we played in. You know, narcotics were readily available in training rooms, but I'm still responsible for what I put in my mouth. And I think God was preparing me for what I do now, because this is real life and death here. You know, I used to think when I was out on that field that football was life and death, but it's a game, you know, it's a game, and it's something that I allowed to become who I was instead of just something that I was good at. But I think God was preparing me to do what I do now, to get in the doors that I do, to get in front of the guys that I do, to get in front of the families that I'm able to because of being a former pro football player. And, you know, people ask me what I miss most about football. And you know, it's not the game. It's not being out on that field in between those bleachers and under the lights. You know, it's not that. I miss the locker room. And that's what recovery has given me back, is an opportunity to be with like-minded people who have cried with me and laughed with me and struggled with me and been to those dark places that I've been to. And, you know, that's my new locker room now, is my recovery.
And I love that, you know, bringing up, I mean, just obviously God, you know, put you in this situation. And, you know, a lot of people do like to focus on the fact of why me, but I love that you get to take the positive out of it and see that, you know, you got to rebrand yourself almost. You have this new identity. And, you know, you talk about how narcotics were so readily available, you know, back in that era, back in the 80s, 90s. Where do you see the future of this going almost? You know, are the narcotics less available now? Where would you see the future of this program and everything going?
You know, I think through our advocating over the last 12 years that the NFL is now more accountable. I know that there's certainly more protocols to have to go through before there's no more off-label prescribing like they used to do when we were there. Team doctors cannot prescribe narcotics in on away games in different states, you know, only the state that they are certified in. So there's a lot of things that we were able to do, but, you know, I still deal with players and to some extent it still goes on because, listen, players put pressure on themselves to get back out on that field, you know. Coaches put pressure on team trainers to get back out on that field. You know, owners put pressure on team doctors to get that player back out on that field. So all that mentality is still there. And as long as that's there, guys are going to do whatever they have to stay out there because, you know, if you're not out there in your position, somebody else is going to be, you know. And, you know, we have too much pride, too much ego. We've worked too hard to get to where we are to let somebody get in our spot because of an injury.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. I love the fact that you said that it comes downhill, right? It goes from the coaches to the trainers, from the trainers to the players. And I think that's another really important piece that people need to understand is that it's not just, oh, this guy's just, you know, trying to push himself back on the field. No, it's a downhill effect on top of this being your job now. You said that earlier in the beginning that this is no longer a game. This is how I feed my family. And for guys like yourself, guys who've been playing for a while, not only are you providing for your family, but there's other people that's around you that's tied to you that's also benefiting from the fact that you're really good at what you do. And I think all of that stuff goes into that pressure of guys forcing themselves back onto the field time and time again and trying to prove that they're good enough to continue playing. When in reality, you know, I think when you've made it to that level, there's really nothing else to prove. I think that if you're saying I got your position, you're saying I got your position. But like you said, it's the downhill effect from the coaches to the trainers, to the players. I mean, I would even go out to say even from the owners to the coaches, because yeah, it's a business and that's an investment into their guy. And so they want to see that their investment is producing in a sense. So I love the fact that you did, you know, went ahead and said it rolls downhill. It's not just, you know, randomly happening. It really does come from the top down.
Well, and we all want to be, even though we've made it to the pinnacle of our sport, you know, we still want to be the best we can. We want to be all pro, you know, we want to be pro bowlers. We want that next big fat contract, you know, we want all that. Once we get there, we're still competitive and we never stop trying to be the best that we can be. And, you know, then that's the added pressure that we put on ourselves once we get there. And if you're not out there on that field, you ain't getting there.
I feel like there's so much added pressure too from fans. You know, I mean, I feel like a lot of times fans lose sight the fact that athletes are real people too. You know, they just sit there and they expect them to perform the way that they want to perform, but you know, they don't understand. They get injured too. They have bad days too. They, you know, go through things too. So I feel like there's a lot of added pressure there as well.
Yeah, there is. And that's where you got to have to kind of tune out social media and everything else that's going on. It's given fans a platform to pretty much speak. And you're talking about armchair quarterbacks, you know, guys that have never had on a jock who are trying to tell everybody how to play a position or how to run a game. So you give people a platform like that, and they're going to abuse it. But you just got to have to block it out. You got to do the best you can to just block it out. You know, I know that I read an article not too long ago on Tom Brady. And of course, he has social media. He has all this stuff, but he doesn't pay any attention to it. He doesn't even get on it during the season. You know, so he's got somebody that's probably doing tweets for him or making Instagram posts or whatever. But, you know, he's so laser focused on football and the next game that's the kind of players that are out there today that are doing such a great job.
Yeah, I think the first time I noticed that was when they started kind of talking about how LeBron would do that in the NBA his season, and he would do this like zero dark 30 thing, and it would be I think it's like towards the end of the season going into playoffs where he would just completely get off social media, and I was like, I wish I would have known that to use that technique to get off, because it is social media can be a phenomenal place, but as well as a very, very dark place. Because I mean, I know if you've seen multiple stories, but you know, when guys don't have great games, now the fans have this platform to go and just blaster them and say whatever they feel to say. And it's like Lauren said, like, we're still human. Like, we are just as disappointed in ourselves as you guys are, the fans. And for them to have their platform to say whatever they want to say and comment whatever they want to comment, that is some undeniable pressure. I mean, I had a couple of teammates to actually just quit football because that pressure was so heavy, having to deal with fans and comments that were made. And on top of, you know, coaches, you got to sit in the meetings and the coaches got to dissect the film and this, that, and the third. And so I love the armchair quarterbacks, but at the same time, it could definitely be harmful as well.
Yeah, you're right. And thank God I didn't have to worry about that back when I played back in the 80s. You know, we just had to worry about somebody throwing a beer bottle or a D-sized battery at you, you know, while you're sitting on the bench, especially driving into the dog pound up in Cleveland. You know, you never knew what you were going to get hit with up there.
True. I do want to ask you, what was the loudest place you've played in the NFL? Loudest place.
Wow.
Crazy, you know, fans, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, probably somewhere like the Superdome, you know, or back in the day, you know, I can remember some of those Lion games up in Detroit being so loud in the Silver Dome. You know, those domes were just kind of built like that. And but yeah, there was some of those Chicago games, even though it was open air, there was a lot of people there, especially that 85 team, you know, when they were Super Bowl bound and doing their Super Bowl shuffle and all that stuff. You know, that was a pretty chaotic team and stands then too. How about you? Where was your loudest place?
Let's see. I would Bronco probably
stadium pretty loud too.
Oh yeah, yeah. The stadiums for sure. And so I've kind of had the opportunity to play at multiple teams. I would say LSU, TCU, and then the Broncos. I'll probably say Death Valley is probably the loudest place I've ever played.
Really?
With everybody right on top of you. The student section is 25,000, 30,000 kids that's going crazy. And I'll never forget my sophomore year. They had just built the they extended the far side. I want to say it's the east side They extended it up, and so it went from 94,000 to 114,000. And so you're talking another 10,000-20,000 people, you know, yelling, screaming your name, you know, doing all the cheer stuff. So I'll definitely say Death Valley is probably the loudest place I've ever played.
Did you have to go to a silent snap count?
Oh yeah, 1,000%. 1,000% for sure. Definitely. The center will snap it whenever he's ready.
Right. Oh, the good old days.
Oh yeah, nothing like it. I do want to go back to the beginning of the story. Like, so love at first sight is a real thing.
For me,
it was for you. Okay. It's not across the board for everybody, but for you, yes, it definitely works.
No, it was for me. I don't think it was for her. I had to work on it for a while, but I finally convinced her. But no, we did. We got married after our junior year, and I have no reason. I have no idea why, because neither one of us had anything. We had another year of football or another year of college. And, of course, I didn't know I was going to be drafted that high or if I was even going to make it in the NFL. But we took a chance, and I knew I better get a ring on it because I didn't want to lose it. You know?
Absolutely.
I kind of want to ask, going back to, you know, your transition story and recovery and everything like that. How was your family through it all? Because I feel like oftentimes, you know, in a lot of those stories, sadly, the family doesn't stick around. You know, how was your family through all of that?
Well, I put them through hell, that's for sure. And they're the real heroes of my story. You know, if you talk to any one of them and hear some of the things that I put them through and the fact that they're still here, you know, they're the real heroes. I can remember sitting at a picnic table in the middle of the rehab campus, and I was sobbing uncontrollably, man. I just couldn't get a grip on this. This was 2 weeks into my treatment, and I went into treatment September 22nd of 2009. But I remember sitting at this picnic table and crying uncontrollably about 2 weeks into the process of rehab. And for some reason, I used to get up every morning and just write. And I don't know why, I'm not a big writer, but it made me feel better to just write down what I was going through and what was going on around me. And I can remember thinking, for the first time in 20 plus years, I'm having to deal with all the pain and destruction or this huge path of chaos that I left back in Houston with my family, with my friends, with my reputation, with my finances. And I was having to deal with that sober for the first time, you know, life on life's terms, you know. And that was kind of like, it was like all when all that was going on and I couldn't get a grip on myself, it was like somebody came up behind me and like draped a warm quilt on my shoulders. And I'll never forget it. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was on a Wednesday morning at 8:45 in the morning. I'll never forget it. 2 weeks in. And it was like they put a quilt on my shoulders. And I say a quilt because I remember feeling weight and warmth on my shoulders, but also had this unbelievable, overwhelming sense of confidence that not only could I do this, but that I had to make it mean something. I had everything that I'd put everybody through back in Houston, I had to make it mean something. And that right there, that Wednesday morning at 8:45, that was kind of the birth of this nonprofit, Athletes in Recovery. Like I said, I didn't know what I was going to do with it or how I was going to use it, but I knew that I had to do something with, I had to make all of this mean something. And that was kind of my burning bush spiritual awakening to recovery. It was right there at that picnic table that morning.
Man, that's powerful. That is powerful that you had that moment. Because like you said, like we said earlier, you know, there's opportunities for us to transition and begin to start that process. But I feel like in that story, I feel like, I guess in that moment is when you like finally let go. You finally...
surrendered.
Yeah, you surrendered.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, surrender to it. And just all that weight just kind of fell off you. And that's beautiful, man, because there is that moment, you know. I think I'm far better now in the transition process doing the things that I'm doing. But I can also agree with you that there was that moment where you just like, whew, okay, all right, let's move forward. Let's make this mean something. And I wanted to ask you, you know, what became your why as you transition into speaking, and now you're an author, and now you're like helping these families and helping all these people. Like, what was that thing that kept you going outside of your story? I'm saying, what is that thing that was like, okay, I got my confidence this morning. I'm moving. I'm working. I'm making these things happen.
Man, you know, my why is just, I have buried so many people in the last 12 years, you know, ever since I've gotten clean and sober. There's so many of us that don't make it, you know, and that's my why. It's the 92,000 people that overdosed last year just as a result of opiates, you know, where, and I'm not even talking about the 88,000 that died of prescription related medication overdoses, or the hundreds of thousands of people that pass away as a result of alcohol abuse. My why is those guys that are struggling with traumatic brain injury and CTE, mental illness as a result, you know, having mental health issues. That's my why. There's, and it's not just athletes. This is everybody, you know. That's my why is, what's my part in it, and what can I do to make the world a better place? How can I help this pandemic within a pandemic, you know, because this thing is, we're not going to arrest our way out of it. We're not going to legislate our way out of it, but I do feel like we can educate our way out of it. And the more that guys like me open our mouths and put our hands up and share our stories, then the easier it's going to be for that somebody to raise their hand and ask for help, you know, because this disease happens to anybody. And it's okay to not be okay, you know, but you have to ask for help.
I just have to say, I'm in awe of how, you know, transparent you are with everything, because there's some people who, you know, will stand up and speak out, but I love how transparent you are with your story and everything that you've gone through, and, you know, the stories that you're able to share, and, you know, you are making a difference, and, your story's going to go, you know, be told forever, because, you know, you have made a difference. So, you know, thank you, obviously.
Well, I hope so, because believe it or not, this is the kind of stuff that keeps me sober every day. You know, they say you got to give it away to keep it. So this helps me more than it helps anybody else.
Well, I'm glad. I really am. And, you know, Randy, we want to thank you so much for joining us today and answering all of our questions. Your story is very, so inspirational. And again, I just want to thank you for sharing it and, you know, taking something, you know, negative and turning it into something incredible.
A mess into a message. Hey, listen, thanks for having me, and have me back sometime. Okay. Let's talk
Absolutely.
About, let's talk about something more uplifting.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Most definitely. Most definitely. We got to get you back.
Like the Baylor Bears. Let's talk about them.
Hey, before you go, we just got to say go Frogs.
It's only right.
It's only right.
I just knew we were going to be having frog legs on Saturday, but it just didn't work out, did it?
We got appetized with bear first. We got hungry with bear first, so mm-hmm. It's all right.
Y'all did. Y'all definitely outplayed us.
All right. Well, thanks, Randy, and we hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. You want to go ahead and get into the game?
Let's do it. Let's
All right, guys, we got an upset alert.
Upset alert.
Upset alert. TCU defeated the number 12 Baylor Bears 30-28 on Saturday.
Yes, indeed.
What a game.
Man.
What a game. I'm still stunned. I'm shocked. You know, we went into the game and we were like, our preview, we were like, well, you know.
Yeah.
We'll
yeah.
see, but we'll wow. They outdid themselves, I really have to say, you know, and I just have to go ahead and start off, Chandler Morris.
MVP, done. Done. MVP.
That's my first note. MVP, game MVP.
Done.
Done. So next, move on. No,
yeah.
I, you know, we've talked about so many times on this show how Lincoln Riley is a quarterback machine.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that, like, he not even that he really did much with Chandler Morris, because he wasn't really at OU. I think he was there for, like, what, a year, and he didn't even do anything. But But the faith that he had in him, you know, shows that the guy had to have some sort of talent, and he did. He showed his stuff in this game. I saw some cool stats, actually.
Yeah.
He's the first TCU quarterback to pass for 400 yards since Kenny Hill, his now coach, in 2016. And Chandler Morris is one of just two quarterbacks to surpass 300 passing yards against Baylor this season. So,
wow.
MVP.
MVP. Golly. MVP.
Give him the name.
Man, Chandler, dude. I mean, gosh, like, I haven't watched a more exciting, like, freshman this year, playing a quarterback position. I mean, besides the talent, right? I mean, we know he has the talent. He came from the quarterback whisperer, Lincoln Riley himself. Like, he has the talent, but the moxie, the demeanor, the communication, like the swag, the style, like, it's like it all came together at the right time. You know what I mean? You know, on top of all the news we dealt with last week and Coach P and this, that, and the third, like, it's almost like a Cinderella story almost. And I mean, we still got, you know, football to play, a lot of football left to play, but I mean, geez, like, this kid he was poised, very, very confident. And like I said, just the moxie to play that position and to lead your team in a situation as it was. It's not like Baylor was bad. Like, you know, they were clearly 7-1 before they saw us.
Yeah.
But for him to step up to the plate, take that opportunity, and to show the world what he could do, that's amazing. That's amazing in itself. I mean, local kid from Allen, so I know Allen is, like, probably still partying right now. Allen, Texas is. And so, like, you know, just to seize that moment, man, was very, 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 like, encouraging to see.
No, for sure. And the leadership he showed, I think it's almost like he was kind of the missing puzzle piece that we needed, you know, this whole time. And, you know, obviously there was a lot of energy going into the game, just playing Baylor and stuff like that.
Right.
But no, he definitely showed up. He got himself out of some, you know, sticky situations. I think he was really good at that. There were multiple times that, you know, their defense was going in for the sack, and he got himself out of it multiple times. So, no, definitely hats off to him. Played a great game and led us to victory.
Yeah, man. Yeah, very Houdini-like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
In and out. I do also want to say as well, like, I think hats off to Coach Meacham as well. That's the Doug Meacham that we – are used
to. No, love.
Yeah, you know, that's the guy we're used to. Like,
yeah.
Looking at the stats, you know, Chandler was 29 for 41. I mean, 40 pass attempts, like, we're throwing it. Like, you know what I mean? We're throwing it. And not to say that we couldn't rush it. I mean, we had 35 carries as a team, but, like, we're putting the ball in the air. If we got 400 yards passing, like, you know, every other play is a pass. And I think that is honestly, that's TCU's true offensive identity. Let's let it ride. Like, yes, it helps us to have a Zach Evans, you know, it definitely helps us. We're 1000%. But I think that we are more dangerous as an offense and more potent as an offense when the ball is in the air. Quentin Johnson had a phenomenal game, another phenomenal game. I mean, 142 receiving.
That one-handed catch, yards. Though.
Yeah.
Like, oh, crazy.
Come on, man. Like, you're in the zone. You're in the zone. Like, I don't know how many listeners we got, how many guys that's listening play football. But when you catch a one-handed ball in the game, like, it's kind of like Randy was saying, you almost kind of, like, black out, and you're, like, in this zone that nobody can, like, really, really get you out of. So, like I say, phenomenal day across the board for TCU's offense. But that's the Doug Meacham that we absolutely love. Put it in the air. Let it fly, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I love seeing that, too, because we've been talking about all season how predictable we are as an offense. And, you know, we had Zach Evans out. We had Kendre Miller out early on in the game. So we were down to one running back. And, I think it definitely made us, you know, unpredictable. And it was better because, you know, Baylor was really on our really on our running this game in the beginning. So actually the whole time, and we didn't have that many rushing yards. So I love the connections between Chandler and the receivers, and yeah, that definitely helped us see that victory. You know, a lot of the questions that I got from Twitter and Instagram were, what's next for Max Duggan? Will he see the field again? And should he be scared about his job?
That's a really, really good question, because I was going to mention this earlier. We was talking about Lincoln Riley. I want to say, this is not confirmed, but I did see an article that's talking about Spencer Rattler leaving OU. And not to say that would be the case for Max, but that is the, I don't want to say danger in having a transfer portal, but it kind of is, you know, and, you know, it's hard. It's a tough situation, right? Because, you know, you have your guy that's been there for, you know, 2-3 years, and he clearly demands, or he's in control of that position, obviously. But then when you open up opportunity to a Chandler Morris, who steps up to the plate and who answers the bell, you know, as a coach, you're kind of in limbo. Like, which way do I go? Do I try to play them both? And I mean, we've obviously seen that situation as well, try to do the two quarterback thing, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's next for Max. I mean, I hope he stays. I hope he finishes out his career where he started it. But you know, again, with the whole transfer portal thing, like I understand it if you know that becomes in consideration for him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm kind of on the same path. You know, I do have to say, you know, I personally, I hope that we would hopefully start out Chandler Morris, you know, at least in the next game, see, you know, because you never know with the momentum, with the energy, if it's just a one game type of thing. But no, I mean, the kid has the talent, you know, and they're both great guys, both very talented. But yeah, I would definitely love to see Chandler Morris start against Oklahoma State next weekend.
Yeah, let's go. Let's put it in the air again. Let's go 2 for 2.
Yeah, I saw something the other day too that was makes sense why Lincoln Riley was holding on to him so much in the offseason. We get it now.
Yeah, we got it. You can't have him back, Lincoln. We got him now.
It was a secret little weapon.
Yeah, of course it was. Of course it was. But we appreciate you, Lincoln, for prepping us one and gifting it to us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for that one. I wanna go ahead and talk about the defense, because you know our guys on offense, you know, even if they don't connect, you know, on a day, I feel like on paper we have, you know, a really talented offense, and we have a talented defense too. But they've definitely, you know, had their ups and downs this season, and this game they just connected. They did everything they needed to do, you know, and even though the game was close, you know, they kept us in the lead the majority of the game, which, you know, was great. We had the lead going into half and, you know, everything, and that huge game-winning pick at the end. So definitely hats off to the defense as well. They showed up, they did what they needed to do, and that's, you know, that's how you win ball games.
Yeah, I'm still not sure on who was calling defensive plays on Saturday, but I believe just from what I saw during the game is that I think we kind of stuck to I think that's the trash truck outside, I think. But I think we
kind of... It's okay. My dog is growling in the background. So.
Oh, it's okay. Perfect. I think we kind of stuck to the basics, if that makes sense, because we know Coach P. Coach P is he's a play caller on defense, meaning he tries to match plays with plays. And I think that when you don't have that common denominator in the equation, now it's, okay, all right, well, let's just play our base defense. Let's do what we, you know, do well. Let's stick to the basics, the simple things. And everybody do their job and everybody, you know, stays on point. And I think the defense did an excellent job of that on Saturday. Everybody sticking to their assignment and doing their 1-11. And it definitely helps when you got your offense, like, chunking the ball and scoring. Like, energy is feeding off each other. Offense feeds off defense feeds off offense. So when your whole team is in sync like that, you're hard to beat. I think we did a great job of containing their quarterback. Bohannon and you know, their stud guys on offense. And again, I think it's hats off to whoever was calling the defensive plays on Saturday. Like, phenomenal job of sticking to the basics and, you know, putting guys in position to win.
Yeah, for sure. And I watched the press conference with interim coach, head coach Jerry Kill, and you know, he was kind of saying that the guys have been through a really tough week, you know, like even things that we don't know about. And you know, he was just really proud that they were all able to show up. And you know, I know they were out there playing for Coach P, they all said it, I think that was really cool. It was a great game to, you know, kind of hats off to Coach P. This one's for you guy, or you, for you dude.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, you could definitely see the fight, the spirit, mm-hmm. and just the intent that was behind, you know, how that game was played. And I got to give like a special shout out to Shad Banks, who had the game winning interception.
Freshman.
Funny story. Earlier this year, like during fall camp, I went and visited Kenny. We sitting down, we just talking, just doing what we normally do. And he comes in and he's sitting in the chair. Shad is. And Kenny's just telling me about the kid. He's a freshman, you know, this, that, and the third, da, 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 da. And, you know, I, after that conversation, I really didn't think much of it, right? And then before that play happened, I was outside. I ran to my car real quick, and then I came right back in. And it was right as it was happening. Interception, boom. He makes the interception. He runs to the sideline, jumps on the bench, takes his helmet off. I'm like, that's the kid. That's the kid right there. So I had this whole like moment. And then I don't know if you saw the clip that TCU football posted, but he did like a backflip in the middle of the field. Like it was like right after the game had ended. He like ran to the middle of the field, did a backflip, and like the whole team was behind him. But that's personality.
Awesome.
Yeah, man. That's his personality. That's his energy. So like I'm super proud of that kid for the way he played and showing up big in that moment, man.
Oh, that was huge. I mean, you know, I didn't work this game. It was, you know, my last game that I got to go kind of sit in the student section, you know, do the fan thing. So I was in the student section in the stands watching it when it happened. And, you know, it was a nail biter. All Baylor needed was that one. All they needed was a field goal. And they had just, I'm pretty sure they had just passed field goal range. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was definitely a nail biter. They still had a minute left, a whole lot of game left to play. And that was a huge game changer on him. So that was awesome to be a freshman. And I loved the energy. That's incredible.
Shout out to all the freshmen, man, balling this week. Shout out to freshmen. All the freshmen balling.
For sure. I love it. You know, I kind of want to go on to something a little bit funnier, I guess you could say, now that we won. I don't think it would be as funny if we didn't win, but those refs, man. I kept saying, man, Baylor's not our enemy today. The refs are our enemy.
Yeah, man. I think we're just good at just getting like some of the
worst refs. Toughest.
Be nice. Toughest. Okay. We'll go with toughest. Yeah. We'll go with toughest refs. I mean, and not to say
you're the well-spoken one here.
No, you got it today. You got it today. I mean, not to say that their jobs are easy at all. You know, my dad is a referee, and you know, I hear stories about calls that they make all the time. And so not that their jobs are easy, but I do think that sometimes those calls aren't thought all the way through, you know, because, I mean, quite honestly, they're making a judgment based off what they see. Right. And, you know, not to knock any referee, but they are older. Sometimes you see things that you don't, that's not necessarily there. You
hey,
know?
You said you were going to be nice.
I mean, I am kind of a little bit, but still, like, sometimes some of those flags, y'all don't really see that stuff, right? I mean, yeah, it may look like it, but from another angle, it's totally different. So, I mean, you know, not, like I said, not to bash the referees, but I think we just are really good at getting some very, very tough guys. I think so.
Well, and it happens in like an instant too. So I'm like, how do you see that half the time? No, I mean, even, you know, we got a targeting call on defense, and thankfully they overturned it. But yeah, there were some snap judgments there, and we finished the game with 19 penalties overall. Which,
I'm still trying to figure out how we managed.
Is that
to
a
get...
record?
It's gotta be. I mean, because even the commentators were talking about it on TV. They was like, Wait, TCU has over 100 yards in penalties, and they're still winning the game. Like, something doesn't quite add up here.
No.
And it's like, I mean, but we won. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's that's what I'm saying. It would have been a different conversation if we didn't win.
Yeah.
But we won. Yeah, but it's okay. We won.
It works. It works.
We won. But yeah, overall, it was a good game. And, you know, I've been saying we play like this here on out. You know, we've been talking about how strong the back half of our schedule is. You know, we got Iowa State coming up. Oh, OSU this upcoming weekend. Yeah. You know, who is number 10 now. So, yeah, we got a strong back half of our season. Notice how I didn't name the other team.
Yeah. The
He who shall not be named, whatever. I really think, you know, we've been saying all season, it's the reps, and I'm hoping, you know, that we kind of mesh together. We got that puzzle, you know, built, and if we play like this here on out, we might actually be bowl game eligible.
Yeah. I mean, hey, two away. All we got to do is go 2 for 3 right here, 2 for 3. And I definitely think we most definitely have the guys to do it. The opportunity is coming. The opportunity to do it is coming. And, you know, like we said before, like, they just got to be on one accord again, you know, just like this past weekend. And, you know, again, hats off to Chandler Morris. And sometimes it takes some fresh bodies in the game to kind of, you know, change up some things, make some things different. I got to, you know, give a shout out to one of the commentators of the game. He said, you know, for defense, you know, when you don't have film on that guy to prepare for that week and he goes into the ball game, you're kind of lost. You really don't know what he's capable of, what he can do. And, you know, sometimes the good teams, they make the adjustment at halftime and, you know, they figure out how to slow the guy down. But, you know, I can only imagine what Oklahoma State now has to do to prepare for both Max and Chandler, because it's still up in the air about who's going to play, who's going to start, whatever. So, I mean, I think we got the advantage going in this week of having two guys that can get it done. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see this upcoming week, but two away, and we'll be bowl eligible.
Well, and I think that kind of goes off to the, you know, predictability thing also. I think, you know, after this week, we showed we can run. You know, we got Zach Evans, Kendre Miller, and even Mercado. You know, he plays well as well. And, you know, we're unpredictable too. We got Quentin Johnston. We got Darius Davis. We got Tay Barber. You know, you never know where that ball's going to go. So, I think I definitely agree with that. I never really thought about that, but you're so right.
Yeah. So Oklahoma State got to figure some out.
They do. We
got some momentum right now, so.
Absolutely. Hopefully we keep going. Again, in the press conference with Coach Kill, he was saying that, you know, it was Saturday, right, immediately after the game, and he was like, we celebrated. We got another ball game next week. Like, we got to go.
Yep. 24-hour rule.
It's time, yeah.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, I guess, you know, we'll be back in a few days to preview TCU versus OSU. The Horned Frogs are going to be heading to Stillwater next Saturday to take on the Oklahoma State Cowboys, who are now number 10 in the nation. Kickoff is set for 7 p.m., I believe. So we got a night game going on at an away stadium. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We want to thank you guys for joining us and giving us your questions this week. And we'll see you on Friday.